Good morning, everyone. It's another week, another bunch of stuff to talk about today. One blog post, actually, which has gone really, really well, a little bit better than expected, but a bunch of other things in advance. And I think what I'm finding is, as I do these videos, if there hasn't been a lot of blogging stuff, there's always a bunch of other things worth filling in the time. So a little quickie first. I got a new webcam the other day. Now, there's a security angle to this. I'm just going to pick it up and try and show it on the screen just here. So for those of you that are watching the video, this is a Logitech Brio. And look, as far as webcams go, it's a good webcam. It does 4K video. It has what I think is a very nice picture. But the thing I was particularly interested in is it's Windows Hello compatible. And Windows Hello is sort of Microsoft's brand for the way you authenticate to your machine. And one of the ways in which you can authenticate is via facial recognition. Now, to qualify this, because this is not just like a camera and then you can just get a photo of someone and hold it up and you log in. In order to be Windows Hello compatible, it's got to have an infrared sensor, for example. So now you've got an IR sensor and a camera as well, and it's got to meet all sorts of standards in order to actually be usable for authentication. So I particularly wanted to get this so that I could put my machine on a faster lock cycle. And mind you, this is the machine I have at home, right? This is my desktop. It doesn't travel. My laptops that travel all have fingerprint biometric auth on the Lenovo. So I'm running the Lenovo 920 and the P50 at the moment. So they're great in terms of travel machines, but the one at home, I'm typing in this sort of complex password every time I lock it, and I'd really like to have a fairly aggressive lock cycle when I'm away from it. So got the Brio. It actually works really, really well. So I'll come back to my machine. Let's say I've gone downstairs to get a coffee. Get a coffee, come back upstairs, machine's locked, screen's blank, move the mouse, look at the camera over there, and you can see the little infrared light flashing, and then usually, bang, you're straight in, which is super cool because it's sort of much faster than entering a password, no manual labor. If someone is with me and they're sitting with me, then they don't have to see that. And because it's well, they don't have to see that. What am I talking about? They don't have to see me entering my password. And because it's Windows Hello, it also integrates with 1Password. So when I go to unlock my keychain or my 1Password app, it will do the Windows Hello with the cam just the same way as it does it with the fingerprint readers on the laptops and also the fingerprint reader on my iPad and the facial recognition on my iPhone. So it's kind of interesting to look at this because we're sort of getting better at auth mechanisms that don't use passwords. And of course, we still have passwords. That camera doesn't work all the time. Sometimes, frankly, it's a bit painful, like when I was wearing a hat. So I've had to keep training it. You can go back in there and go, refine my results. And then it goes, oh, Troy's wearing a hat. If he's wearing a hat when he sits down, I guess we can log in now. So that's all good too. Now, there will be those who are going to be skeptical because there always are. This is the internet. And in terms of the security posture, or rather the risk it creates, that the main thing is that this camera is only any good, assuming there's some vulnerability or you can do like a plastic mold of my face. It's only any good if you have physical access to the machine. So this is not going to allow like Sergey in the Ukraine to, and I'm sorry, I know that's a very stereotypical hacker thing, but the numbers are there. It's not going to allow some like remote threat actor to authenticate to my machine. So you do have to be physically present at the machine. So I'm finding that this is actually allowing me to tighten my security posture while still actually having the usability of making the machine a practical thing to use nonstop all day. So that was the first thing. And I thought that was interesting. If people have questions about that, let me know and I'll see how we go over time. I've only had it for a couple of days, so it's pretty early days. Now, another thing, totally unrelated. I'm teaching my son, my 8-year-old son, HTML. And the background for this is that the school recently said we're going to have like different programs, not like software programs, but like school curriculum programs, where some kids can go off and focus on mathematics and others on music or things like that. And somehow my son ended up with web development, which I thought was pretty cool. So he had to go to a different school for a day, and there's kids from all these other schools come to this school to do web development. And I was sort of obviously really interested in what that would look like. So I dropped him off at the school, picked him up later on and was like, right, what did you learn? And I'm thinking it's going to be like drag and drop WYSIWYG kind of crap and probably never actually seeing any markup. But he had pages and pages of HTML tags. So, okay, sweet. So, you know, he's learned what a body tag is and a head tag is. And that was actually pretty cool because I didn't think that that was really the way they'd be teaching kids. Like, I'd hoped that was the way they'd be teaching kids, but I thought they'll probably shortcut it. So I have now gone, all right, since you've started that, you probably should build a web page. So I set him up in Visual Studio Code yesterday just because it's, look, I mean, I could have put him in Notepad for all intents and purposes because I want him writing tags, but it's like if it's in Visual Studio Code, then we're one step away from doing like source control and stuff within the environment. It does help you do some auto-completion of tags and this sort of thing. So he's now building a web page, and it's just all HTML so far. No CSS, certainly no JavaScript, nothing like that. But I thought I'll just get him starting doing that. And I had this flashback. I'm going to grab a book. Here we go. I'm pretty sure I've showed this before. So the book I'm holding, for those just listening, is HTML for Dummies. And this is the actual book, the real sort of stained, old, raggedy book that I started learning HTML from in 95. So it's, I actually sort of thought it was pretty cool that like 23 years on, probably 23 and a half years on now, the way that you learn to build web pages is still pretty similar. I mean, I probably did it all in Notepad at the time, but he's got a fancier IDE, dark theme. So that's it's just kind of neat. Now, of course, this was pre HTML4 as well, so we weren't doing even CSS back then. It was just basic stuff. But I'm just pretty impressed that for an 8-year-old kid at school, they're like, "Yeah, learn HTML. Like, this is sweet." So I'll see where he goes with this. I like the fact that there's sort of a I'm reticent to say programmatic because people get upset and they go, "HTML isn't programming." Who cares? There's a coding side to it. And then as he progresses a little bit, we'll start to bring in some CSS and he can start learning to do something that's a little bit more left side of the brain and get a bit visual. So I think that's really cool. If you do have kids, I'm finding that for as an 8-year-old, this is something that he can quite easily understand. It's basically just learning the syntax of the tags. And then I'm sort of saying, like we just started with, okay, we need HTML, then we need a head and that'll have a title. Then we'll do a body. Let's do an H1. And then we got to talk about hierarchy. And then down a little bit, we'll have H2s, and these will be the things that you're interested in. And let's create an ordered list of the things you're interested in. And then these are the list items. Now go and find a website about it, and we'll make a hyperlink. So this is sort of the way I've been going about it. And I think as we progress, we'll sort of do just a few more fundamental things. We might even go find a YouTube video you like. Here's how to embed the HTML. Just so he can sort of see it working with other things. And I think if he sees like visual, graphical, exciting stuff on the page, he might like it a bit more. Anyway, questions, ideas, comments, please leave those on the blog post. Now, a couple of other things. One, look at my list here. One very positive thing, and then one thing that's absolutely just pissed me off this morning I'm going to cover as well. So the positive thing, we are progressing with the Mozilla Firefox and Have I Been Pwned integration. So I wrote about this a while ago. Mozilla was very public about doing a sort of a testing cycle of the integration where their Firefox monitor service can search Have I Been Pwned. That's all going very, very well. We are moving forward into the next phase. I think they want to sort of keep timelines and things a little bit quiet at this point. But certainly what they originally announced and what they wrote about is going well, and we'll be seeing more of that in the near future. So I'm very excited about that, and that has actually led to me spending quite a bit of time on Have I Been Pwned, tweaking a lot of the things. A lot of this as well, incidentally, all the new stuff I'm building out is running on Azure Functions, and I've written about this before. I'm moving some of the old stuff into Azure Functions as well, because they are just such an epically good way of scaling very quickly and also paying per use. And this is much better than the old model of how we're doing things with logical machines and platform as a service. Now I'm talking at .NET Conf, which is a remote conference that anyone around the world can watch. I'm talking there I think in about 2 weeks, pretty sure it's about 2 weeks from now, must be about the 14th of September. And I'm going to talk a lot more about that then, particularly this sort of, I guess, maturity matrix of going, you've all probably seen the old charts of we used to have on-prem and then infrastructure as a service and PaaS as a service and software as a service. And now we've kind of got serverless, incidentally still runs on servers. And this is a great, great way of building apps today. And of course, I'll be talking about the Cloudflare bits on top of that as well. So look out for that. I probably should write that presentation. I might write it next week. Anyway, so let's move on to the other thing. And this has really, really bugged me. And I'm going to give you the flow of this. Now, just as a theme, a personal theme, the stuff that really bugs me is when we see misrepresentation of facts for personal gain. Now, let me give you some context here. So someone tweeted me this morning. This was only a couple of hours ago now. And they said, just having a chat with Namecheap about SSL certificates on their shared hosting plans and thought Scott Helm and Troy Hunt would like to see this. Safe to say I'll be getting my hosting elsewhere. And the bottom line is that Namecheap is obviously selling certs. I believe they sell Komodo certs. And they would like you to buy those certs because they make some money out of it. They would not like you to get a Let's Encrypt cert because they don't make any money from it. So this bloke, Ed, is having this chat with, this guy's name is Sergey. This was not intentional, the Sergey thing before. Having this chat with Sergey, and basically just weird stuff from Sergey about not getting any validation assurance. What's he said here? Encryption. The key distinction between Let's Encrypt certificates and SSL certificates from trusted CA, the way he says trusted as well sort of implies that Let's Encrypt isn't, is that free SSL certificates provide encryption, i.e. scrambling of data during transmission to prevent tampering only, which it is not only that. There is the whole sort of verification that you are actually on the correct site, the authenticity side of things. Encryption is important, of course, but to get the crucial component of validation, you need a purchased SSL certificate. And the really weird thing is, as I've subsequently learned, is that when they say validation, they're not even talking about EVOV. They're saying go and pay money for DV. Now, that would have been it, were it not for the fact that someone pointed me at a post, which I'm pretty sure I didn't see at the time because I'd remember this, from Let's Encrypt in January last year. So we're going on sort of a year and a half plus ago. And this was in response to a Namecheap article specifically targeting Let's Encrypt and telling people everything that's wrong with it. And the sorts of bullshit that Namecheap have come out with here is just, it's just unfathomable. And I'm reading this blog post here from Josh at Let's Encrypt, who, to his credit, has done a very good job at actually remaining polite and mature, which is more than what I'm about to do because some of this is just ridiculous. So, you know, the claims from Namecheap here, and to be clear, this was the start of last year, but it's still happening. If it wasn't still happening, we wouldn't be having this discussion. It's things like the disparaging of Let's Encrypt because they said there's no OVEV support. Well, yeah, fair enough, which is incidentally useless. To issue a certificate with medium or high assurance and user trust level. It's just weird. many people don't want or need them. They've said there's no Windows IIS support for now, which was bullshit because even back then, as Josh has said, there are a number of Acme clients for Windows. Namecheap says insufficient level of domain validation and the absence of brand validation. Now, there's plenty of domain validation. That's the way it works. It's literally the name of it. They're DV certificates. And Josh has sort of replied here and said, our domain validation system is generally agreed to be solid, if not significantly better than other systems. And of course, there are baseline requirements for any CA to do proper validation of the domain name. Otherwise, you don't get to be a CA. So that's just crazy. Namecheap goes on, multiple machines hosting the same name can't get a separate cert for each machine. Can't get a separate cert. In a nutshell, it is not possible to reissue the certificate, make the server vulnerable for drown attack. Now, Josh has very politely said this is entirely incorrect. I would more accurately class this as just being absolute bullshit again. None of that is true. Namecheap says there's no policy on automated blacklist. Once you're blocked by the system for hosting malware, you cannot get a new cert for some period of time. Josh says, not accurate. Goes on with reasons. But so, like, so far, a lot of this is like, let's just be disparaging for our own personal gain, which is clearly what it is. They want to sell the Komodo certs. They want to make money out of it. But some of this as well just shows that they actually have no bloody idea. So Namecheap has said, Cypher suite configuration is still manual. The certificate installation is automated. All other settings are manual. Cypher suite configuration is always going to be something which is entirely independent of the CA anyway, or entirely independent of the issuance process. You're going to have to set that up yourself. It doesn't matter whether you get a Let's Encrypt certificate or a Komodo certificate. Now, if the hosting provider then automates some of it for you, that's a different story, but that's not a CA thing. Root access needed to run Acme script. Indeed, some plugins can be installed on shared servers. Still, they do require at least sudo access. There are clients available which will run without root. It's Josh's statement there, but I think that's perfectly clear. It just goes on and on. That one of their arguments was no wildcard support. Let's Encrypt does now have wildcard support, so that was true at the time. No longer true. That gets thrown in the toilet with all the other shit. exposing the private, so this is Namecheap again, exposing the private key to third party, it is considered insecure practice, as once the private key is compromised, it's relatively, you know, okay, fine, you don't want to expose the private key to a third party. Let's Encrypt doesn't do that. And they make it very, very clear. We've never, ever encouraged or required people to share their private keys. They've then said there are multiple vulnerabilities in the Acme protocol and attacks, which I think this is where Josh is just starting to, like, you're testing the guy's patience. He says, this is uninformed FUD. Acme has been repeatedly audited by third parties in the cryptography community, and there are no known vulnerabilities. And it's just, even to the point of their Namecheap is trying to argue that the validity period, the 90-day validity period, is a bad thing, which is just absolute crap, because it's a good thing. We want certificates to expire as fast as possible, because if ever there's a compromise, then you've got that built-in assurance that they're going to be rendered invalid, even when revocation is fundamentally broken in different ways. And of course, the trick here is automation, because if we can automate the renewal of certificates, I'd be happy if it was a 30-day expiry, for example. I don't care, so long as the automation works. So I thought I'd bring that up, because it just sort of continues this pattern of FUD from commercial CAs who are seeing their market eroded by there now being free certificates. Now, and to be clear, commercial CAs, we've seen a lot of this sort of crap from Komodo and Entrust before as well, but also certificate resellers we see this from, and I'll put Namecheap in that same category. I've called them on it pretty directly in tweets. We'll see if I get any reply. I looked in, through their Twitter timeline. They do seem to reply to people. They're mostly trying to appease people who are upset about things by the look of it. So there might be some other issues there. I'll link to the tweet in the notes for this week's update, because I really would like to see a reply from Namecheap to address that. And again, it's not just the January last year thing. It is the fact that even today, we've got old mate Sergey touting this bullshit. Incidentally, someone made the comment that he replied very, very quickly. It looks like he'd copied and pasted it from some sort of formal manual. So maybe Sergey's fine, and like he's doing SSL support today, and he'll be, I don't know, selling Tupperware tomorrow or something, and he's just a call center operator, which actually kind of makes it even worse, because if their standard responses are actually formalized and documented and pushed out to everyone, this is not just one rogue agent. It's like this is a company posture. Let's see where that goes. All right, other things. Oh, here's a beauty. Crazy HTTPS tweet. This is the title of it. Now, why does HTTPS attract so many crazies? Like everything from the Namecheap stuff through to the EV stuff. Incidentally, I've got an epic EV Smackdown post, which I will put out next month for reasons that will become clear then. Also, last day of winter today for us, summer tomorrow. So it's basically just going to be sunny again. Anyway, so I will put that out in September, because there's going to be another thing that happens in September that this will time in very well with. All right, so the epic HTTPS thing. I got an email from someone. Now, I get a lot of emails. I'm now at the point with emails where I pretty much have to file the vast majority of what I get without responding, because there's just too many. I want to be contactable, and my email address is on my Contact Us page, or Contact Me page. But if it's not something that really requires action, I've just got to file it. And unfortunately, that does mean a lot of stuff that, that is very honest, legitimate, from nice people with good questions, but it's just too much stuff for me to take on board. Occasionally, I get stuff like this. Let me read this to you. Hi, Troy. As someone who has built their own HTTP server, your articles are really not helping the world. HTTPS is a huge waste of oil, coal, and gas. So are HTTP2 and WebSockets. Also, my HTTP sites are not secure because I use a single server salt. Please correct this or write your own HTTP server and power it without using your power outlet. Now, when I get an email like this, obviously the first thing I do is share it with Scott Helms so that we can have a good laugh about it, because this was just ridiculous. And I have shared this in a Twitter link to it. It's been liked 1,024 times now. That's a nice number. Been liked 1,024 times. And when I got this, like, there's always this question of, is it someone just trolling, just looking for a reaction? So I definitely do not reply to stuff like this. I'm not going to engage in discussion. But the thing is that once I shared it, the vast majority of people were like, this is just outrageous and crazy. And there was also a slice of people here who were sort of saying, well, this guy's just trolling. But the problem here is that I cannot tell HTTPS trolling from HTTPS crazies. Now, Scott Helm wrote that blog post a little while ago I've discussed before about HTTPS anti-vaxxers. And there were people on there saying things like, HTTPS is just a Google conspiracy theory. There's prominent people, right, who should know better, but certainly know well enough not to be trolling. Yeah, HTTPS is a Google conspiracy theory. HTTPS is a massive book burning exercise because you're going to kill all the HTTP sites. I'm going to find the video now. Well, I can't find the video because this is the interesting thing. One of the segments on here that Scott wrote about was from a guy who did a video series about how bad HTTPS was. And it was stuff like, oh, the NSA has backdoored all the HTTPS. Anyone who can read Reddit will be able to learn how to create their own certificates and fake HTTPS. All just batshit crazy stuff. All those videos only just the other day got deleted too, which is interesting. So now Scott's got all these embedded videos that look broken. The videos that we have embedded in our Everything is Cyber Broken talk, which we'll be doing at NDC in Sydney 3 weeks from today, those videos aren't deleted. They're still in there. Talk not recorded as well, because we do lay it on a bit. So the point being that maybe it's a troll, maybe it's not, but it is so consistent with the genuinely crazy misunderstandings that people have that I just don't know the difference. So I'm pointing me at Poe's Law as well. Now, Poe's Law is worth mentioning. I'm going to read the definition for you. So Poe's Law is an adage of internet culture stating that without a clear indicator of the author's intent, it is impossible to create a parody of extreme views so obviously exaggerated that it cannot be mistaken by some readers for a sincere expression of the paranoid views. In other words, when it's on the internet, unless you're being really, really clear that you're being sarcastic, you just can't tell the crazies from the real people. And this does appear to be the case here. One person said that maybe it was a bit unfair to use the word crazy about someone. I disagree with that. I think this is exactly the sort of place that we would actually say someone's a little bit crazy. You have a read of the tweet. I'll link to it. You be the judge. All right, on to blog stuff. And I'm going to talk about pwned passwords. And pwned passwords, as I've spoken about many times before, is being used really, really extensively. I mentioned recently that GitHub is now using pwned passwords as well. They've downloaded the 517 million SHA-1 hashes. Every time someone logs onto GitHub, if you're using a password that's been pwned, you get a big notice about it. So fantastic, that's there. The API is still rocking. We're still getting many millions of requests every single day to that. Probably next week, I will try and write a blog post that breaks down precisely how that service works, where the costs are, and how I'm keeping it so low. And I've got the cost down a lot since the last time I spoke about it, when it was costing just over $1 a day. I just realized the actual return on effort of trying to reduce a cost that's only just over $1 a day is not very good, but it's fun, damn it. I'm going to do it anyway. All right, so the thing that I've now done is I've published those hashes as NTLM hashes as well. So let's sort of take a step back and explain the background. When we are working in an environment where there is an Active Directory domain controller and you have people in, say, a normal corporate environment signing up, or rather having accounts created for them, setting passwords, they go into the environment as NTLM hashes. NTLM hashes are not salted. I link in the post to a Security Stack Exchange article about why not. It is a very, very different environment to having a website where, yes, you would absolutely positively salt and bcrypt and all the rest of it. So what that means is, not being salted, is that if I have a set of NTLM hashes of pwned passwords, they can be matched directly to the NTLM hashes in an Active Directory environment. I had a number of people asking me for this, and originally I was like, is it sort of enough people to warrant doing this? And then a couple of people popped up at one time, and I know, how hard can it be? So I basically just scripted out the process, pulled down the 517 million plain text versions I maintain in a local database, NTLM'd them all, zipped them all, put them online. They're all downloadable now. And that is the NTLM hash and the prevalence of the password against it. Now, this blog post has gone really, really well. It ended up on the front page of Hacker News the other day. There was somewhere in the order of 50 or 60,000 people went to my blog. What day did I post it? On the 28th, 3 days ago, on Tuesday. And a heap of people have now downloaded it. And I'm seeing tweets about the prevalence of accounts within their organization using a pwned password. Just before I started recording this, someone tweeted that a quarter of the people in their organization were found with a pwned password. So think about what this means from an organizational standpoint. In fact, let me read the exact tweet from this guy, and I'll link into this. Well, I finally got the NTLM hashes downloaded, and for 1,800 plus accounts, the number using pwned passwords is a whopping 25%. And then we've got the dog in the fire drinking the coffee saying this is fine. So I'm going to make sure I put that tweet in my notes now. That's fascinating. Imagine if a quarter of the people in your organization are using a password that has been seen somewhere in a data breach before. Now, there are still people that decry the logic of this. They'll say, well, doesn't this mean that soon there'll be no passwords available that haven't been used before? And I can only surmise that their mathematics is not real strong, because when you think about the total possible range of passwords, and there's just this tiny, 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 tiny 517 million blacklist. No, it doesn't mean that every password is going to be blacklisted soon. What it really means is that these passwords have been seen public somewhere. Now, as I've said before, this is not very, very frequently not strong passwords anyway. And there's several reasons for that. So number one is that people don't regularly create strong passwords. Number two is that a lot of the passwords in this system have come from corpuses that people have cracked. And even when it's MD5, you don't crack genuinely strong passwords. Now, of course, that depends on your definition of genuinely strong. For example, no one is cracking an MD5 hash of a one password generated 40 character password. The mathematics on that, and we can do this mathematically, are just not in favor of cracking it. So the point is that the vast majority of passwords in there are absolutely terrible. And even if you sort of go, well, I don't want to have a password that's only been used once or twice, blocked from everyone in my organization, that's why there's the counts, so you filter them out. I would argue that if a password has been seen, especially multiple times before, that's not a password you want someone in your organization actually using. So this helps solve that problem. So I would really, really like people to keep downloading this and using it. It's all free. There's no attribution requirements or anything. Download the set, check in your internal environment, and then you get to think about how you deal with it. So what's the discussion you have with people? And I'm really interested to hear how different organizations handle this, because this is now a communications piece as well. And of course, the reality of it is too, is that you know that the people that you need to talk to about this have made a bad decision, which is almost certainly counter to the corporate security policies, which are all say, don't reuse your passwords. If you're using it there and it's been breached somewhere else before, you're either reusing it because it was your account, or you have a dog with the same name as someone else's, or you've used some other terrible logic at deciding what password you should use. So if you do have that conversation in your organization, I'd love to hear how it goes. Comment anonymously if necessary. I just want to know how companies are dealing with this, how it's useful, and particularly how it can be more useful as well. So if there's ways that we can improve this and get more people creating good passwords, then that is a good thing. All right, last couple of things. Blog sponsor this week is DigiCert, the CA who is doing good things. And trust me, I'm very cautious about who sponsors this blog post. And if it was a CA who fell into the category of some of the others that we've mentioned just before, it would be a different story. But DigiCert has really stood out from the rest in terms of the way they've handled things, particularly the way they've handled the sort of overly promotional nature of things like EV. So I'm happy to have those guys there as a sponsor. What are they talking about this week? They are talking about how fast can you update your security after an algorithm is compromised. And then they've got an interview and tips and things here with DigiCert CTO. So there's actually a link through here to a public piece here on CSO Online. So it's a public news piece. Thank you for DigiCert. I appreciate what they're doing, not just for my blog, but for actually upholding a little bit of ethical standard in the industry. Now, last thing, travel-wise. So next week, I will be doing some domestic travel. I'll be speaking at API Days in Melbourne on Tuesday. I spoke at API Days in Sydney years ago, and it was a really neat event. So I'm going to go and talk about how your APIs are getting pwned, and I got a lot of material. So I got to do that. And I'm also going to a Fortinet conference on Wednesday in Sydney. So I'll be there on Wednesday. In fact, I'm doing the conference. I'm doing a bunch of media stuff. I'm doing a panel. Then I'm getting on the plane and coming home. Also, while I'm here, I'm going to be talking on Thursday morning, my time, for Veronis. And I'm going to be presenting the Modern State of Insecurity talk, which is the talk that I did at InfoSec EU in London in June, I think it was. So I'm going to be doing that online. It'll be live streamed. I'm sure they'll make that available offline as well. So I'll put in a link where you can register for that and come and have a look at that talk as well. So that's it for this week. We'll see what I get up to next week. Obviously, I've got a bit of travel coming up as well, so that will keep me busy. I do want to get that thing about pwned passwords written up as well, because it's really fascinating how the cost effectiveness of that has improved even more. So thank you very much for watching. And to my point about the comments on different things, they really do help. I do obviously read them all and respond to any comments that actually need a response. And thank you very much, everyone, for listening. See you next week.